Succession number 4410, reel number 6.
Sir John Glubb, reel 3.
Yes, within the first 4 or 5 days after the end of the mandate, the Jewish forces began to occupy the whole of Jerusalem. We had 5 very hectic days, because one regiment of ours, was outside the Jerusalem enclave, watching the Jews conquering everything, going ahead, heavy shooting and bombing going on and so on. But we were told, don't interfere, the United Nations will act. In the end, after 5 days, it became obvious that very soon there would be nothing left of Jerusalem. From the point of view of King Abdullah, who'd been made a king meanwhile, he was terribly distressed about the mosques and the holy places, because Jerusalem is a holy city to Muslims as well. So he was in a state of great anxiety. And eventually, on the 5th day, the Transjordan government said, all right, go on, keep them out of the old city and the holy places. So we had to break into Jerusalem with 1 regiment. And there was a good deal of street fighting, and we did succeed in stopping the Jewish advance at the old city and a line from the old city to the north. Half or more of the Arab areas had already been occupied by the, we may now call them Israelis often. And also the hills to the east of Jerusalem, the Mount of Olives, and the Jewish University, the Hebrew University, which had been built on hills east of Jerusalem, that is between Jerusalem and the road down to Jericho and Jordan. Meanwhile, Israeli troops were pouring up the road from Tel Aviv into Jerusalem. Apart from this political or religious significance, Palestine consists of a fairly flat coastal plain along the shore of the Mediterranean, from Gaza up to Haifa. And further east, a north and south line of mountains, from Hebron, which goes up to Nazareth. Palestine has frequently been divided in the past, but nearly always one lot have held the mountains and the other lot have held the coastal plain. And that was what we should have liked to do, but of course the partition plan didn't quite fit the geography. But if the Jews got a large army into Jerusalem, it meant they were on top of the mountains. And of course the foot of the mountains was the place to defend the Arab areas. So Jerusalem had a strategic significance in addition to its political and religious significance. If we had allowed them to occupy the whole of Jerusalem, they could have driven down to Jericho and across the Jordan. So to reduce the number of Israeli troops sent up into Jerusalem, this key position, we sent a battalion forward to the edge of the mountains and the hills, of the mountains and the plain, where the road from Tel Aviv came across the plain and up through the mountains to Jerusalem. That's a place called Latrun. At that place, we blocked the road from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem to prevent their building up a large army in Jerusalem, which could have driven straight over into Jordan.
Was it easy for you to get there, to Latrun?
Yes, it was all right as long as we were clear of Jerusalem, because that's all Arab area, north of Jerusalem. All the mountains were Arab. The Israelis were only in the plains. And from Haifa eastwards down another plain, Esdraelon, to the Sea of Galilee. But from Esdraelon down to Hebron, the mountains, with the exception of Jerusalem in the middle, was all Arab. Fighting went on for a month, during which the area of Lydda and Ramle, which were allotted to the Arabs by the United Nations, were in the flat plain. Jaffa was also allotted to the Arabs. All three in the flat plain just beside Tel Aviv. We had about 3,500 men. The Israelis had about 60,000. But these were all in different categories, so they're difficult to compare with one another. The Arab states had absolutely no connection, no liaison, no understanding between each other. The Egyptians arrived across Sinai. The Syrians made one not very successful attempt and then withdrew. The Lebanese had no army and took no part at all, with the result that the Israelis occupied Galilee, which is an area allotted to the Arabs, along the Lebanese frontier. Halfway through the fighting, the United Nations sent Count Bernadotte, who was the brother of the King of Sweden, as United Nations mediator, he was called. And he succeeded in arranging a month's truce. We had by this time lost the portions of the flat plain which had been allotted to the Arabs. Because, I say, we had so few men, it was quite impossible for us to drive down into the plain just outside Tel Aviv. So Jaffa, Lydda and Ramle we didn't attempt to defend. We defended the foot of the mountain range and Jerusalem city itself, half Jerusalem city. Well, Count Bernadotte dashed round both sides and eventually produced a scheme for certain adjustments in the United Nations partition plan, which was really extremely unpractical. I mean, the United Nations plan had been very unpractical, and he produced a plan with certain alterations, chiefly based on the idea of giving areas inhabited by Arabs to the Arabs and areas inhabited by Jews to the Jews. This had not been observed in the United Nations partition plan. For example, the Beersheba area, which was almost 100% Arab, was allotted to Israel by the United Nations. The Arab states, who were always rather chaotic, adopted their foolish attitude of boycotting the discussions in the United Nations. The Israelites, or the Jews of Palestine as they were before Israel was declared, pleaded and brought a great deal of evidence and influence to bear on the United Nations, which is in New York, the biggest Jewish city in the world. Anyhow, Bernadotte made suggestions to modify the plan. But one day he was driving down our side. The two front lines were opposite one another, but they were not shooting. He came down our side, and I actually saw him and spoke to him, had a discussion. We gave him an armored car escort. Then, in Jerusalem, he crossed the line into the Jewish-occupied western part of Jerusalem, where a trap had been laid, and he was stopped and assassinated. Well, we thought, well, now the Israelis have really put their foot in it this time. Assassinating the United Nations emissary, that's a bit tall. We'll have all the United Nations intervening. Not a murmur. There wasn't even a protest, as far as I know. Nothing happened at all. So at the end of the month, the question arose of prolonging the 1 month's truce which Bernadotte had arranged. The Jordan Prime Minister went down to Cairo, where there was a discussion among the Arab states. And this is scarcely credible, but the Egyptians opposed prolonging the truce. When I had begged the Jordan Prime Minister to prolong it further with a view to making peace. The Israelis were overwhelmingly stronger. Moreover, in the United Nations, all the members had agreed not to supply weapons to either side. But during the truce, the East European countries, in other words, Russia, sent weapons to the Jews, to the Israelis, which were landed on the beach, including, I think, armored personnel carriers and various forms of... It's rather interesting, because since then the Russians have come out as the heroes of the Arab side, but during the fighting in 1948, they were actually supporting the Israelis, thinking that the Arab countries were rather under British influence. When the Prime Minister came back from Cairo and I asked him what happened, he said, we've decided not to prolong the truce. I may mention that while the Israelis received weapons from the Iron Curtain countries, the Western allies, who were our allies, stuck to the United Nations embargo and refused to give us anything. So whereas the Israelis continued to build up their strength, they received aircraft also, we received nothing and in fact were running out of ammunition. So I begged the Jordan Prime Minister to prolong the truce and start negotiations. He came back and said, we've decided not to prolong the truce. So I said, why? And he said, well, the Prime Minister of Egypt says he's been criticized in the press for not having driven the Jews out of Palestine and consequently doesn't want to face any more press criticism. I said, but the Egyptians have shot their boat. The Israelis are daily getting stronger. This is absolute suicide. However, fighting recommenced. The second period of fighting went on very much the same. The only change in the situation was that a small force which had arrived from Iraq crossed the Jordan and joined the Arab Legion in Palestine in the Nablus area, that is the northern half of the mountain range. While this was going on, then there was a period of another month's fighting. Then another armistice was agreed to. The Egyptians had meanwhile occupied a considerable part of southern Palestine, most of which was a Jewish area, but also near the coast there were a large number of, most of which was an Arab area, but along the coast there were a number of Jewish colonies. The Egyptians did not cooperate with us at all. We had no idea where their troops were, what they meant to do, or anything else. Eventually, a second armistice was agreed to. This time, the shooting didn't really cease. Periodic outbursts of shooting continued all the time. Then, eventually, to replace Bernadotte, we got another United Nations arbitrator, whose name I've forgotten, I'm afraid. And he arranged for all parties to meet on the island of Rhodes. The Egyptians were the first to go and concluded a separate armistice. I think Syria or somebody went next. Then Jordan went. The Iraqis refused to go. When the other countries went to Rhodes to negotiate with Israel, the Iraqis suddenly withdrew their forces, which left the Arab Legion alone facing Israel on the west bank of the Jordan. Eventually, an armistice was concluded. But as I say, was called the shooting armistice. People went on shooting. After that, when we were all supposed to be at an armistice with one another, the Israelis suddenly attacked the Egyptian army. There doesn't seem to be any means of avoiding the impression that they did this on purpose. Although, at the moment, they made up a story that the Egyptians had fired on a convoy. Anyhow, if they had fired under armistice conditions, one would have said, here, let's discuss this incident, we must prevent these. Instead of which, the Israelis launched a major attack of about 12,000 men against the Egyptian army and drove them out of the whole of Palestine after a brief siege of a place called Fallujah. The armistice was renewed and the Egyptians abandoned the whole of Palestine. the next problem, a new phase followed, during which, although there were quite frequent bursts of shooting, nobody made a military advance or attack on the other side. But the Arab Legion alone was left facing Israel. During the Israeli advance, or its occupation of Jaffa, Lida, and Ramleh, and various other places, the Israeli army had driven out all the Arab inhabitants. Any place they came to, they drove all the inhabitants out at the pistol point. The result was that streams of refugees in the clothes they stood up in started pouring into Jordan. All of these had left all their property behind. They came on foot running. Some were country people who'd had farms and land and crops and orchards. Others were townspeople who had shops and houses and so on. When the armistice began, firing nominally ceased, a number of these fugitives tried to go back, either to see what had become of their homes, or to try and rescue some of their property. The Israeli army shot everybody whom they found, as it was called, infiltrating, that is, crossing the line between the armies. We in Jordan did the best we possibly could to prevent the refugees from going back to look after their property. But it was impossible. We had a 350-mile-long border, and it's quite impossible to prevent people crossing at night. But when these refugees found that they were shot whenever they were captured, they themselves took arms with them to defend themselves. And so gradually a guerrilla warfare built up. We did everything we possibly could to prevent this. We made every attempt. There was an armistice commission in Jerusalem which was supposed to deal with incidents. We made every attempt, both through the Armistice Commission and direct with the Israeli authorities, to put an end to this sort of guerrilla shooting up by civilians. Didn't do anybody any good. A lot of people were killed. It certainly would not dislodge the Israelis from the lands they'd occupied. And it only kept the thing on the boil all the time. The Israelis absolutely refused to cooperate. I suggested joint police patrols. I suggested trans-demarcation line telephones by which either side could report infiltration by people from the other side so that their own forces could take action. Nothing was any good. The Israelis refused to do anything at all. My own opinion, I don't state this as fact, but I was in charge for 6 years under this situation, is that the Israelis did not want to stabilize. They hadn't got as much territory as they wanted. And so they wished to keep the thing constantly on the boil so that it would be open to recommencement of hostilities under some pretext whenever it suited them. Whereas we promised to do everything we did to prevent infiltration, the Israelis refused to cooperate, but they adopted the policy of reprisals. One of the worst of these was one morning the Israelis reported to the Armistice Commission that an Arab had come at night to the edge of a Jewish settlement and had thrown a bomb in at a window, which had killed a woman and two children. So we were told this, and I immediately offered to allow the Israelis, they used dogs to follow the trails of people. I immediately offered to allow the Israeli police with their dogs to follow the trail of this fellow across the border into our territory so that we could see where he came from. We got no reply to that, but 2 days later, Israeli military force of approximately brigade strength attacked the village of Gibeah, which was 2 miles, I think, behind the Jordan line. It was a very well-planned attack. Not only did they carry the village, but behind the assaulting troops were other troops carrying large quantities of explosives. And these they deposited in all the houses in the village. Meanwhile, the men of the village had been trying to skirmish with the Israeli troops, but the women and children were cowering in the houses. So as they placed a pack of explosives in every house and blew them all up, the whole village was leveled, and all the women and children were buried inside. The whole village was reduced in incredible degree, just a heap of rubble. This was a reprisal for the murder of a Jewish woman and two children. I forget how many people, I think about 60 Palestine Arabs were killed in the reprisal. We gradually extended our system of defense against this kind of thing by putting barbed wire around villages. And we trained and gave rifles to a few men in each village. And in fact, they did repulse one or two raids by Israeli troops. We put an Arab Legion NCO in each village to organize their defense. But the difference is that whereas the people who crossed the border or the demarcation line into Israeli-held territory were fugitive refugees whom we tried to prevent, all the crossings from the Israeli side into Arab-held territory were by the regular Israeli army. This went on for 6 years, during which there was no major change, but continual shooting and crossings by individual or groups of two or three refugees who began to take submachine guns and hand grenades with them, and counter-reprisal raids by the Israeli army attacking villages near the demarcation line. In 1956, I left Jordan, but from 48 to 56, I was in charge of this Israeli Jordan demarcation line, and never succeeded in getting any cooperation at all from the Israeli authorities, who, as I say, the only impression I could receive, this is my impression, I can't say this was so, but the strong impression I received was they didn't want a settlement because they were waiting the opportunity to take more territory, which would have been more difficult if a treaty had been arranged and hostilities had been terminated. Then it would have been a national border. But as long as the whole thing was a shooting armistice, any pretext might arrive any moment to enable them to take more territory. And that's when I came away.